Hi, everyone, and welcome to One Question with Pastor Adam. And I'm Adam, and I'm pastor to believers and doubters, to unfaithful Christians and faithful atheists. And friends, Jesus wasn't afraid of asking questions, and so neither are we. So each week on this podcast, we are going to explore questions that you may have, that you may have sent me over Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. And today we have a big question, a universal question. And I am so excited to introduce you to my friend Gareth Higgins, who has written a fantastic book. And I'm going to go ahead and bring Gareth up. And as I do, friends, if you have comments or questions for Gareth about our topic today, I invite you to bring those in by putting them in the comment section. So it's my pleasure to bring in Gareth. Hi, Gareth.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so good to have you. And thank you for writing this fantastic book, How Not to Be Afraid, 7 Ways to Live When Everything Seems to Be Terrifying. And everything seems to be terrifying these days, Gareth. So I'm looking forward to talking with you about this book. Gareth and I met, how long ago was that in Chicago? 10 years ago? 12 years ago?
No idea.
It was a long time ago.
Time really got compressed and expanded at the same time, which is part of the issue with fear. So I have no clear memory of when, but it was good when we did.
It was good. Yes.
Here's Fozzie, who's part of my practice regarding fear is the practice of delight and joy and wonder. But maybe we'll get to that.
I think we will get to that and beauty. And there's so much beauty in Fozzie the Bear.
Yes.
So thank you. Gareth is an author, storyteller, activist. Gareth, you have a PhD in sociology. Nicely done.
Had a really good professor.
You did?
Well, he taught me. I mean, my professor actually taught me the value of mentoring. I have great admiration for anybody who gets a PhD and doesn't have a really good relationship with an advisor or a professor, mentor. I was fortunate. I always used to say about my professor, John Brewer at Queen's University in Belfast, you would give him a piece of work and you would often get it back that afternoon and it would be covered in red pen. You know, there'd be red ink all the way, like cut this, change this, but he would get it back to you like sometimes even within minutes. And I learned the value of being very carefully, thoughtfully mentored.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah, very good. And Gareth is a sought after speaker at conferences and on podcasts. So I sought after Gareth and Gareth said, yeah, sure, let's talk. So Gareth, thank you. And friends, once again, if you have questions, comments, you can put those in the chat section. Gareth, I thought maybe we'd just start with talking about fear and the title of your book, How Not to Be Afraid, because as I was reading your book, it's much more about how to manage fear, this universal feeling that we all have that can stifle us, freeze us. So what are you trying to do in this book? First, before you answer that question, I just want to make a plug for this book. There is some music that pick up the pieces within me and put them back together. And there are very few books that are able to do that. And this book is one of them. It's filled not just with theory, it's filled with beautiful stories that are personal to Gareth and also are able to speak to the universal human condition. And so I highly recommend it. What are you trying to do in this book when it comes to fear?
Sure. Well, I mean, at the simplest level, I'm trying to help myself. And this is one of those, a very pure example of someone writing a book because I'd experienced some things and I wanted to move forward with those things. A lot of fear in my life, fear of external threats coming at me and fear of things inside me, which I'll say a little bit more about maybe in a minute. But you asked me what I'm trying to do with it. How Not to Be Afraid is the title, but it's the same knot as the knot in the TV show What Not to Wear. Because I've never actually seen What Not to Wear, but my guess is it does not end with a lot of naked people every episode, right? It's not saying don't wear anything. It's saying here's how not to dress and here's how to dress. And How Not to Be Afraid is not saying how to not feel fear ever. It's suggesting, and I think it's evidence-based, that, or a more poetic word for that is it's true. it's true, I think, that a lot of us are fearing the wrong things, or we're fearing the right things in the wrong way, which is that we fear them too much or not enough. And we certainly spend a lot of our lives being dominated by fears. Even if they're accurate, we could do something perhaps better than being dominated by them. Fear is totally natural. It's an evolutionary inevitability. And it comes from the experience in our distant past of our forebears being attacked by saber-toothed tigers or by rampaging villagers from the next village over. And over time, our brains have evolved these little fear devices called the amygdalae in the brain. They're the size of almonds. They look a little bit like almonds too. And they are, as far as we know from neuroscience, what gets triggered when we feel the thing that our culture calls fear. And, you know, wherever you feel, I feel it in my chest, sometimes in my temples, sometimes my legs kind of freeze. And we have this threefold, three different responses to fear: fight, flight, or freeze. Fight back, run away, or freeze. We all identify with those three responses. Sometimes this is healthy. Sometimes the amygdala are responding to stimuli that it's good to feel the fear. For instance, don't walk too close to the edge of that cliff, or put your seatbelt on, or don't press your foot too hard down on that pedal. The problem is our brains have not evolved quickly enough to keep pace with the astonishing revolution in how information is shared in the world, particularly since the rise of the internet. We've all got these little devices, and they publish constantly information. The brain on its own, brain chemistry on its own, cannot tell the difference between different kinds of information. It can't tell whether it's propaganda, whether it's statistically accurate, whether it's a lie or wisdom. The only thing that can discern the quality of the information is what I call the storytelling mechanism. And the storytelling mechanism is what's going on in our minds, which are not the same as our brains. It's more than our brain chemistry. And how we slow down and create a filter between ourselves and the information coming at us. So just to kind of close this response to your question, what I'm trying to do is to help myself and others learn practices that will help us tell a more truthful story about the things that are worth feeling fear about. And another word for fear is respect. Actually, I respect the cliff edge. You know that the ancient Middle Eastern teaching that says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. You know, sometimes I've heard that teaching used to kind of beat people up. You know, you need to be morally puritanical. Don't do this, don't do that. Otherwise, God's going to kill you.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think that's the most evolved way to interpret that beautiful poetic phrase. I think a more truthful and more emotionally healthy way to interpret that phrase would be to say a deep abiding respect for reality is the beginning of wisdom, right?
Yep.
The reality is if you walk off the edge of that cliff, assuming that you're not doing through some suicidal impulse, to which I'd feel deeply tender, and I'd want to pull you back from the edge, you know. Yeah. If you walk off the edge of that cliff because you're disrespecting reality, you'll very quickly discover that respect for reality would have been a better choice. And the challenge with these devices, with electronic media, and with a lack of accountability and discernment in our culture, is that the information we're being bombarded with does not necessarily respect reality. And we need to initiate ourselves into learning what reality actually is and start by respecting that. And I think then we'll discover there's a lot less to be afraid of than we might have thought before.
Yeah, I want to get into that. And you talk about how the media saturates us with fear and with violence. And I want to get to that in a little bit. But I also want to talk about you grew up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. And as an American growing up roughly about the time that you did, I would not have known anything about the Troubles. We didn't learn about it in American, at least I didn't learn about it in high school or middle school. So this is not something that's just theoretical for you. You provide practices for how to manage fear, but you also lived this. Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in Northern Ireland and the Troubles?
Sure. So I grew up in a very relatively safe neighborhood. There was no actual violence on our street or very, very, very rarely in our town. But the violence in the conflict in and about Northern Ireland did directly affect my family, my parents in particular, both of whom were bereaved and bereaved on more than one occasion. Both of them would have been near when bombing incidents were either averted or had just happened. And the truth is, anybody of my parents' generation, that's the story for most of them. Most people experience things like that. A dear friend of mine who's only a few years older than me was in a cinema one night, and the cinema was evacuated. And I remember being in a situation like that when I was younger. I don't think I was ever in a theater that was evacuated, but I do remember being in a theater once where they had a translucent, like an overhead projector slide that was slid down in front of the projector for the movie. So a message with words would be projected onto the screen. And it said, there's a security alert outside the cinema. If you're parked on these streets, go and move your car. And I remember my dad saying to my brother and I, you stay here in the theater. I'm going to go move the car. And so that might have actually give you an insight. Violence had become so normalized that they even had an overhead projector slide ready to go, you know. And between 1968 and 1994, about 3,700 people were killed. 43,000 people were directly physically injured. Countless others were traumatized. I didn't experience it as frightening when I was a child. I just experienced it as normal. I knew there was a problem. My parents did a beautiful job of protecting me and my siblings, I think, from feeling the direct fear. It was later on that I started to feel the trauma of it. But by my mid to late teens, I knew there's something here that needs to be addressed. And back to the mentoring thing, I was fortunate enough to fall in among peaceable, courageous, nonviolent activists who were trying to address the legitimate needs that may have underpinned the conflict and say that we can't use violence to do that. What we need to do is to be hearing each other and securing equal rights for everybody across the society. The fear that I experienced on the inside, you know, there was this external sense of threat and, you know, certain places you shouldn't go to and things you shouldn't say. Fear experience on the inside was that I was growing up in a conservative evangelical culture and a very homophobic culture, not just inside the church, but in the culture at large, the secular culture. I'm not really even sure there was a secular culture in Northern Ireland. I'm not sure there's a secular culture anywhere. Actually, my friend David Dark says that in a God-breathed universe, there's no such thing as a secular molecule.
Yeah.
And before I forget, I want to say also, when you mentioned the media earlier, I think we are all the media. And anybody who's ever published anything on a social media account is part of the media. And anybody who consumes the media through their dollars is part of the media too. So I don't see it as being, I certainly don't want to scapegoat this thing called the media. And we should come back to that in a moment. But the fear I felt on the inside was this fear that because I was growing up with questions about my sexuality, my sexual orientation, that I didn't really even begin to resolve until my mid-30s. I had a story that said there's something wrong with me, sin, mental illness, and even demonic possession. Those were the three options. they unfortunately, I was never presented the option of maybe you're just bisexual and that's great. Or maybe you're just gay and that's great. Or maybe you've just got questions about your sexuality and you're working them through and that's great. Yeah. The options I was given was sin, mental illness, and demonic possession. Of course I felt afraid on the inside. Of course I felt afraid. So that's kind of where the impulse comes from. And at the same time, you don't have to have grown up in the north of Ireland or to have grown up queer in a conservative culture to identify with external threats and fear that there's something wrong with you. I haven't met anybody who I have felt has been fully emotionally honest with me who has said, I've never ever felt that there was something wrong with me. Everybody feels that, right?
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of this conflict in Northern Ireland, I'm told that it's Catholic versus Protestant. Yeah. I'm sure it's a lot deeper than that. But what you talk about religion frequently, what role does religion have in helping us manage our fear?
Yeah. So I think religion is a little bit like that word is it's a word like politics, you know, or it's a word like the media, right? You know, there's people who say, I hate politics. And you know, if they're in the UK, for instance, I hate politics. And then I might ask them, do you like your universal healthcare free at the point of need? Oh, yeah, I love that. Well, yeah. I mean, politics made that happen. I hate politics. But I like the death penalty, right? Mm. You know, and religion helped bring about the abolition of slavery and helped perpetuate slavery. Yeah. So I find it's a straw man argument now for people to say that religion is bad or religion is good for me. So how does religion help us with our fears was your question?
I think so, yeah.
Is that your question? Good religion, humane religion, life-affirming religion.
Nice.
The religion that expands love of neighbor and love of myself and love of reality with a capital R. There's a little bit in the book where I talk about the word God, which is, you know, the word God cannot encapsulate what God is any more than the word tree can encapsulate a redwood forest. I think it's Michael Dowd who said that, you know, God is reality with a capital R and then some, right? The ungraspable beyond. So religion that expands our sense of love of reality, dedication to reality with a capital R, and love of neighbor and love of self. And then we define love. I don't think this is a complete definition, but I haven't heard a better definition yet than M. Scott Peck's definition of love, which is something along the lines of love is extending myself for the sake of another. And one of the things I love about that definition is love of self is for a lot of us the hardest form of love to embody. We find it easier to love someone who we may really dislike or who may really have hurt us than we find it to love ourselves. But if love is extending ourselves or stretching ourselves for the sake of another, and you have a real hard time loving yourself, what if you were to see it as a challenge, Adam or Gareth, to see it as a challenge? Could you set yourself the stretch goal of extending yourself for the sake of yourself, for the sake of your tender self, your vulnerable self, the self that has need? So I think religion helps us transform our fears by calling us and then helping us embody through practices that have been well-worn by healthily religious people for hundreds and in some cases thousands of years. It predates the Christian era. Helps us actually embody the transformation of our fears by showing us there's something bigger than ourselves, there's something bigger than our fears. And by uniting the spirit of love in every human heart, it enables me to be in solidarity with those who are more frightened than I am, and who maybe have more reason to be more frightened than I am, and to unite my pain and my suffering with theirs, and then ask myself, what are the resources I have from which I can serve people in greater need than I am in? And where are the places that I lack? And who are the safe people for me to ask for help to? Because the truth is, as you know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, the line between good and evil runs not between this person and that person, but down the center of every person. Mm-hmm. It's the same with privilege. The line between privileged and not privileged runs down the center of every person. Clearly, there are some of us are more privileged than others, but everybody's got something. Everybody's got some gift, mm-hmm. some resource from which they can serve. And everybody, even the wealthiest, most temporarily powerful, macho, physically aggressive person on the planet has some need. They may not be in touch with that need. They may not be in touch with that sense of lack, but it's there. And I think one of the things healthy religion does is helps melt the hardest hearts and create communities in which everybody's needs can get met.
Wow. Yeah. It reminds me a lot of movements that are happening in the United States and I assume throughout the world, like mutual aid groups. Mm. We had fires out here in Oregon during the summer, and we had some anti-fascists come to our church and say, hey, we want to start a mutual aid thing for people who are suffering from the fires that we have here. And these people would not consider themselves, most of them not consider themselves religious. They're mostly atheists. But they wanted to work with a church in order to provide food and clothing for people who were in need. And this is like what you're talking about, like whatever you call it, God or reality or the universe, it's like moving us beyond ourselves to help others. And I asked them, I was like, well, what if a Trump supporter comes? And they were like, good, we'll help them.
Well, like everybody has their reasons, right? And everybody, yeah. You know, there's very few people out there who choose to pursue a line on the basis of, I want to do as much evil as I can and hurt everybody around me. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think this is a place where, like, the media, of which we are all a part, has a massive responsibility for figuring out what the truth is and then telling it. Because there's a lot of people who have opted for a form of politics that might be horrifying to me, but they've done it because they believe the stories they've been told. And nobody on the other side of the political equation has ever approached them respectfully. Yeah. Now, this is not the most important thing in the world. And I don't advocate that everybody should be going to try to build bridges to people who might mean them harm. Yeah. And at the same time, in this society here in the north of Ireland, if people had not done that, we would still be in a state of civil conflict with each other. What happened was people, I see someone in the chat saying, when it's hard for me to love my enemies, I start by wishing them a nice cup of coffee. Which is a beautiful thing. And actually something I think about a lot is when we talk about forgiveness, I think we sometimes put a burden on people who've been harmed to say, you must forgive. And actually, I think, you know, forgiveness is a process that may occur organically, but at the time of the harm, there's trauma to be dealt with, first of all, before you can get into this forgiveness thing. And the first step toward forgiveness is to withhold revenge. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do to you what you did to me. And that might be as far as anybody gets in this life. I'm not going to do to you what you did to me. And there are plenty of people out there for whom that is an act of heroism to not do to somebody else what they did to them. And they should be affirmed and respected for that. It doesn't mean we shouldn't hope for something better. What happened in this society was people who were experiencing harm from each other somehow managed to say, even though your tactics are wrong or might even be called evil because of the harm they were doing, the life that was being taken on all sides in this community, even though your tactics are wrong, we are still going to ask if two wrongs don't make a right, what truth are you trying to communicate here? Is there a truth that you're trying to communicate here? That you've been mistreated, that you've been violated, that you've had rights that you've never had afforded to you before? And because two wrongs don't make a right, we're going to work toward cleaning up our own side of the street. Doesn't mean we have to be friends, and it certainly doesn't mean that you get to exercise power in this society until you've put your weapons down or put away the threat of the use of those weapons. And again, this is not a Protestant Catholic thing. This is about everybody here. I'm pursuing my tendency to go off on 17 tangents. Judy in the chat is asking if I'm safe given the current upset in Northern Ireland. Yes, the answer is totally. And what I'll say about the current unrest is it should be taken seriously, and I don't want to minimize it, but it is not as dominant as the conventionally understood media makes it look.
Good. Charles says, and you talk about the Dalai Lama a bit in your book, reminds me of the Dalai Lama, help others, and if you can't help them, just don't hurt them.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome. Starting with yourself.
Yeah. If you don't feel you can help yourself, don't hurt yourself. You're worthy of not hurting yourself. And more.
Yeah. Similarly, one of the phrases that you used that really struck out at me was the best criticism of the bad is the practice of the good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that comes from Richard Rohr, Father Richard Rohr. I think he says the best criticism of the bad is the practice of the better. Mm-hmm. He also ties that to a phrase, oppositional energy always recreates itself. Now, he does not say oppositional energy only recreates itself. Okay. Sometimes oppositional energy is necessary. Sometimes you need to stand up and say, no, stop, right? Sometimes, in rare cases, some of us need to put our bodies between physical aggression and vulnerable people. But even in those moments, we need to take account of the fact that the oppositional energy we embody is going to create a counter reaction. And we need to be prepared for that, both for our own protection and for what might be the more productive outcome going forward. We don't want to create more silos of people who hate each other in opposition to each other. That's not good for anybody. to the question of the practice of the better being the best criticism of the bad, again, he's not saying don't ever criticize bad things. He's saying the very best and most effective form of criticism is to do the better thing that's not currently happening. I learned feedback loops in it from a Mondo Zen teacher who told me, you know, the way we do feedback in our culture is usually it's not feedback, it's stab in the back, right? So like, I hear you preach a sermon and I didn't like something about the sermon. That's never been the case, by the way. I actually only heard you preach one sermon and I watched it last night and it was beautiful. So I don't like something about it. And so I rhetorically stab you in the back, either in my heart or to somebody else. But true healthy feedback would be, hey, Adam, are you open to feedback about your sermon? And you could say, no. And I would say, okay, that's the end of the feedback loop. Or you could say, yes. And if we had agreed this method together, the way we would do it is so simple. It really changed my life. It would begin with you saying, here's one thing I thought I did well. And then I would say, here's one thing I thought you did well. And it might even be the thing that you'd already said, or it might be something else. And then you've got two things between us that we thought you did well. And then the second and final stage is just a two-stage process. The second stage would be you say, next time, I think I want to do this because that would be better, and here's why. And then I would say, that's exactly what I was thinking, or, well, actually, there's a second thing that next time I think you should do, and that would be better, and this is why. Note, it's not... what did you do badly? It's what is the thing that you will do next time that will be better, and why would it be better?
Yeah.
And the answer can't be, I wouldn't do this. It's got to be, this is the actual improvement that I would do the next time, and this is why it's better. And then there's neuroscience that underpins how this kind of feedback actually gets processed and internalized by the brain better than if I just tell you, hey, can I point out the flaw in what you just did? Yeah. And I could give you 10 items of praise, but you will only remember the flaw. Wouldn't it be better if we actually developed mutual aid societies of the soul where we can give each other feedback that says, hey, 60% awesome job. If you want to make it 65%, here's the 5% next time. And here's why that would be better.
Mutual aid society of the soul.
Of the soul, yeah.
That's awesome. I love it. Let's talk about the media and all of us who participate in the media.
Yeah.
Or all of us who are the media. I was going to ask, and one of the things that we get saturated with when I'm on Facebook, when I listen to the cable news that MSNBC that I generally listen to, is a constant feedback loop of the negative and of violence, and how violence seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. But you, as a sociologist, and other sociologists are saying the same thing, that in reality, we're getting less and less violent. Is that the right way?
Yeah. So in 2016, during the convention season leading up to the US presidential election that year, there was a well-known politician in conversation with a journalist, and he was saying something about, you know, things have never been as unsafe in American cities. And he was talking about for white people, right?
Yeah.
You know, or for white middle-class people, property owners, things have never been as unsafe, violent. You know, the streets are on fire. Things are, I mean, I should step back. I'm paraphrasing him. I don't think he said the streets are on fire. He was certainly saying things are worse. And the journalist said, well, actually they're not. The you know, violent crime rates are decreasing over time significantly. And he then said something like, well, that's what the pundits say. And she said, no, these are actually the FBI statistics, or the official crime statistics. And she, and he then said, well, you may say that, but that's not how people feel. And as a politician, I'm going to go with what people feel. And I thought, gosh, that's a really honest statement for him to make. What I think has happened is that the world has gotten too big and too small at the same time. By too big, until a couple of centuries ago, many of us, many human beings would never have left their own village. And now we feel like we can see into villages that are 10,000 miles away, because we can. We got these, right? That's how the world got so big. We know more about more things than we've ever done, about more places. And what I mean by the world got too small is because of the lack of a wisdom filter between electronic media and our brains, it can feel like the worst thing we heard about today is happening next door, because the distance between things has shrunk. And the problem with that, of course, is it disempowers us from doing anything about the painful things in the world where some of us might actually be able to help. To use a less violent analogy than crime, there's 700 million people living in extreme poverty on the planet today, which is an astonishing figure. It's more than twice the population of the United States. I can't get my head around it. I can't even begin to imagine what 700 million people look like. By the same measure, over time adjusted for inflation, getting to today, 90% of the global population was living in extreme poverty about 200 years ago. So if I tell you, and you know this already, that 700 million people today is 10% of the global population, this starts to reduce the sting and change the perspective, because the perspective becomes, instead of this unfathomable number that I can't even begin to imagine how we do something about, it becomes, gosh, over two centuries, there's been a near 90% reduction in the per capita numbers of human beings living in extreme poverty. Now, you can respond to that statistic one of two ways. If I just tell you there's 700 million people in extreme poverty, you're likely to go, I can't even begin to do anything about that. What's the point in even trying? On the other hand, if I tell you there's been a near 90% reduction in 200 years, you might be likely to go, oh, everything's fine. It's going to just keep getting better. We'll just let that roll on, which is like, there's an analogy. I can't exactly remember where I heard it. It's a great analogy. If you imagine that you didn't know how to do laundry, and you go into a laundry room and you see all the laundry, the dirty laundry strewn across the floor. And then you go away and you come back 2 hours later and the laundry has been done and it's been pressed and it's in lovely neat piles. You would not say, wow, the laundry must have done itself. You would say, gosh, somebody must have done something to this laundry. I'd like to go and find out who that was. Maybe they can teach me how to do laundry. It's the same with the decrease in extreme poverty. And to say that there's been a massive reduction doesn't mean that it's all gone, but it also has to be taken seriously. If we apply that also to violence, if there have been massive reductions or even small reductions in per capita violent crime rates over time, it doesn't serve us to deny that. It doesn't mean that that has to be of any comfort to anyone who's currently experiencing violent crime or has been bereaved through homicide. If my hand got cut off and you said to me, but look at all the other people whose hands didn't get cut off today, unless I'm extremely enlightened, it's not going to be much comfort. But I tell you this, if we know how to prevent more people from getting their hands cut off going forward, I would want that to be extended to anybody that it can be extended to, partly because I feel the potential pain. So the last part of this about the world getting bigger and smaller at the same time, a place of good news, where I think the practices in this book, and really any healthy spiritual wisdom practices, you don't have to buy this book to find spiritual wisdom practices. You should buy this book if you want me to feel better. I think something's happening that's quite wonderful, and that is what's been called the expanding circle of sympathy, which is that more people care about the needs of more kinds of people than ever before.
Mm.
130 years ago in Victorian era England, children were routinely shoved up chimneys to clean them. The Oliver Twist story was real, not the happy parts of it, right? The workhouse, kids being taken away from their mothers, the shame mechanism, and people basically dying on the rack of being put into, you know, effectively indentured labor. And when Charles Dickens wrote Oliver Twist and it was serialized in newspapers, there were some upper middle class and aristocratic women who, because of patriarchal misogynistic rules in the society, were prevented from doing income generating work, had time on their hands, read the stories, got conscientized to the plight of orphans and women in workhouses, and formed social movements that ultimately led to the abolition of the workhouses. There's an example of a class of person, a socioeconomic class, aristocratic, dominant power structure, elite women, and very, very poor people in England, who previously had not had much contact with each other at all. And this class, the one with power, got initiated into empathy for this other group and used their power to help liberate these people. I think this is happening on a global scale because of the internet. And that's why it's one reason why I will not say the media is bad or the media is good. It's like politics and religion. Wherever it can be used to expand love of neighbor and love of self, and a dedicated commitment to the love of reality, which also includes trying to be curious about a deeper understanding of reality and being humble enough to say we don't understand reality, it can induce an ever-increasing circle of empathy. So one of the reasons people feel there's more violence in the world is because we feel the pain of the violence that does exist. More of us feel the pain of more groups of people than before. We can't ignore it anymore. We've got to find some mechanism of transforming that pain into, on one hand, action to serve and reduce violence further, and on the other hand, to not overwhelm ourselves and become sick, emotionally unwell, through the burden of feeling like everywhere we turn, there is suffering. Because that is true, you can find it everywhere you turn, but there is also beauty, and there's a long, noble history of people being able to. Roger Casement, who was an Irish human rights activist in the Congo at the turn of the last century but one, was going and investigating human rights abuses in rubber plantations. But in his journals, he's writing about beautiful men that he sees and gorgeous butterflies by the side of the road on the same day as seeing all this suffering. And I think actually his heir today is Rebecca Solnit, who does the same thing with her Facebook page. There's stories of terrible things, there's stories of activist achievements, and there's literally photographs of birds.
Let's see, just a couple comments. Raylene says that hand parable and many other comments flow right into BLM and ALM of what we have to wait for. It personally affects me. All the abuse, violence, racism will not change. If we can make a change for one, we've lost Garrett. Oh no, we've affected the world. So hopefully Gareth will be able to come back on. We'll see. So sometimes, yeah, here we go. Gareth is back on. Oh, maybe not. We'll see. Gareth, can you hear me? No. Okay. Gareth, if you can hear me, maybe just refresh your browser. We'll see. Okay. Let's see. Laura asks, has volunteering to impact improvement increased? I'm not sure. Let's see. There we go. You're back. Okay.
Somebody clearly is trying to silence my message.
I guess.
Hope, empathy, kindness. It's really dangerous.
Yes. Yes, it is. It is. Oh my goodness. That's awesome. I think Raylene is getting at like the empathy that you are talking about. Maybe it reaches to the struggle. It's not really a struggle, but the Black Lives Matter movement and the All Lives Matter movement that is occurring. The empathy that I get from Jesus in relation to this is that, yes, of course, all lives matter. But Jesus named particular people, like blessed are the poor, right? He named particular people who were suffering because they don't get named. They often get ignored. And so that's why it's important to name the, like James Cone would say, God of the oppressed, right? Mm-hmm. So as this empathy is expanding beyond me, it reaches out to all people, but particularly towards those who maybe are on the margins or have been historically oppressed.
So a friend of mine, Steve Daugherty, who's a pastor and a wonderful cartoonist, does those like New Yorker style cartoons. He wrote about this way. He said that, you know, when scripture says take care of the widows, it does not say in a follow-up sentence, and don't care about anybody else.
Right. Yeah.
It's saying, hey, in this society, widows have been particularly uncared for, particularly marginalized. And until we prioritize the widows, there's something seriously missing with our society. It doesn't mean that other people's suffering isn't real.
Yeah.
But, and I've always thought that God, who am I to even, it's not even my place to assess the meaning of the slogan Black Lives Matter, but as a white person, cisgender, middle class, male, it always seemed to me to be tragic that the phrase even needed to be said, but it wasn't tragic because of anything that Black people were doing. It was tragic because of the structure of the society had left people in a position where it had to be said.
Yeah.
And it has to be said until it no longer until there are no longer circumstances that require it to be said. And it doesn't mean that other people's lives aren't valuable and other suffering isn't real.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain kinds of suffering and certain kinds of people whose time comes, to be seen. And that may be the most beautiful thing about the internet, is that voices that have always been marginalized, excluded, or worse, are now claiming their place at the center and being listened to. And it is a powerful, humbling privilege of a moment for somebody like me to be alive, to get the chance to listen to these voices. And I got my own couple of places where I lack privilege, couple of places.
Yeah.
You know, queer person, still in a society that's not fully eradicated its queer phobia. Mm. And we're in a better place than we were 25 years ago. And hopefully in 25 years from now, we'll be in a better place still.
Absolutely. One of the chapters in your book that really resonated with me was a couple of them, which were the fear of being the fear of not being able to heal from things.
Fear that you'll be broken forever.
Fear that you'll be broken forever. And also the corollary to that, I guess, the fear that you have broken someone else forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Fear that you've done something that can't be fixed.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the ways that you suggest in dealing with that, you get from the 12 steps program, which is living amends. And I hadn't heard of that phrase. Mm. So I would love to hear you talk about living amends.
Mm. Thank you for the opportunity to say something about it. So, you know, amends, conventionally understood, is like if I've hurt you or I've taken something from you, I'm...
Oh, no. Oh, I was really looking forward to that answer. Yeah, the book, Judy, is How Not to Be Afraid. So I'll just hold it up here. And Gareth, as you're coming back in, I'm just plugging your book again. So here comes Gareth. So living amends.
So I might have a chance to like make it up to you, give you back the thing, as to make restitution. But there are occasions, and in the 12-step movement, I think, puts it so beautifully that like we are actually asked not to make direct amends to the person we've harmed if we honestly believe it might cause more harm. Sometimes the act of an apology can actually hurt someone more. So when we make that judgment, in collaboration with wise mentors and friends, I think it's wiser to not do this by yourself. You know, because we often overstate the harm we've done or we understate it, you know? I mean, how many times has someone apologized to you, Adam, and said, I'm really sorry for that thing, and you didn't even know that they had done this thing, and it's almost like, I wish you hadn't told me, or you've said to somebody else, I feel so bad, and they're like, no, that didn't bother me at all, and then they might say, no, what really bothered me was this other thing that you haven't even thought about, right? So most of us have things like that, but then I think in the average life, we all do things that are the occasion of great pain in the lives of others, or we leave things undone that stimulate great pain in the lives of others. Now, part of the good news is that's all happened to us as well, right? So we all know, and so all of us have actually probably done more forgiving than we think we have. We've let something go where we've said, look, there, but for the grace of God, go I, or look, you know, I don't necessarily want to be their best friend, but I don't want them to come to harm either. But if we've formed the judgment that to try to make the amends directly might actually hurt the other person more, the invitation that's made to us is do better next time. Do better with your life next time. Learn from this thing and don't do it again, but do something better, as Richard Rohr would say. There's a beautiful story about a former politician in Britain who was part of a major scandal in the early 1960s and ended up resigning from the government, and the government actually fell as a result of this scandal, and you know, it's a very well-known story in the UK. And this particular politician, my understanding is he went after he left Parliament, he went and worked in a homeless shelter for a very long period of time. He stepped out of public life, but he continued in public service. He had formed the judgment, I'm no longer entitled to have a public platform. That was his judgment. I don't know if that was the only judgment he could have made. Yeah. But I am called to be a public servant. And that's what he did. And he actually lived to a very ripe old age. And I think he only gave one interview toward the end of his life. You know, he didn't make a big spectacle of himself. And I think it would be, we really need to have more examples like that in public life. Because here's the thing, his life was not destroyed by his mistake. Mm-hmm. I suspect he actually came to think that his life got better because of the choices he made after the mistake, that he ended up in a community of service. And he may have felt the wincing pain of regret, but he didn't either deny the harm that had been done, nor was he defined by it. I think we have to offer ways back to people who've made terrible mistakes while looking after the people who've been harmed, you know, and the restorative justice principle doesn't just have to apply to people who would otherwise be criminally charged, right, for acts of violence or so on. Like, I need restorative justice in my life for the pain that has been stimulated in other people by things I've done and left undone. And part of that is to learn from it and try to do better next time. And always, my door is always ajar, both to anybody who wants to hear from me, who has, you know, been hurt by something I've done or left undone. And frankly, anybody, it's hard for me to think, you know, people who have, I mean, I talk about a particular incident in the book that was extraordinarily traumatizing to me that happened when I was 10 years old with some boys who were a few years older and were bullying me. And it was a profoundly traumatic event. But if they wanted to talk to me, or one person in particular wanted to talk to me, I'd want my door to be ajar. And I'd want to sit down and say, first of all, we were kids. Right? Mm-hmm. And secondly, let's talk. Yeah. Let's talk. You know, none of us needs to be defined by the worst thing we've done, nor do we need to go around denying it either.
Right. You know?
So that's what I think living amends mean. And I think we owe it as a culture to ourselves, because we have put burdens on our souls around reifying, which reifying is a complicated word that I think just means making something into a statue that might only be an idea, right? And it might even be an inaccurate idea, but we've made into a statue the idea that this is the most violent time in human history, or there's nothing can be changed, or society's going to collapse tomorrow. That's just causing more suffering. Right. The truth is, society's either true and we're doomed, in which case there is no better way than to lead with love, or it's not true and we're not doomed, in which case there's no better way than to lead with love.
Wow.
Or it's not true and we're not doomed, and everybody out there who thinks we're doomed is going to be really horrified when they realize that they sold all their possessions and bought 2 years worth supply of shampoo in order to prepare in the basement. The last thing we should be doing to those folk is shaming them for the fear that led them down that path. What we should do is lead with love. It's the same answer no matter what the circumstance happens to be. And as my friend Nance Pettit says, I am not saying this from a place of having figured it out. This is a place I love to visit. I don't live here, but I visit here as often as I can. And a conversation like this is actually partly why I wrote the book, to go back to what you asked me at the start, because I need to heal in this area of my life. And talking about it like this helps me heal more.
That's why I preach.
Yeah.
Sure. Often preaching to myself, and I'm hoping universal message in there somewhere. And you hit that in the book. One last question, since we've got 1 minute left. Many of the fear is everywhere. Sometimes it's real, sometimes it's not as real as we think it is. But many of the practices in the book, if it is real, doesn't get rid of the realness of the fear, but helps us to live through it. And I think this is so important. You talk about Viktor Frankl, who was in the concentration camps, and he was able to have similar practices where it didn't get rid of the fear, but it helped him to live through it.
what I would say is it didn't get rid of the concentration camp.
Yeah.
It might actually have transformed the fear. I don't know if Viktor Frankl would say that he felt fear or not. It doesn't get rid of the objective circumstance. It just helps us transform how we're experiencing it. And I use Viktor Frankl as an example with great respect, because I've not lived through anything like a concentration camp, but I'm willing to bet that Viktor Frankl would say to me, how dare you try to erase the value of my writing and teaching by saying that it shouldn't apply to you just because you haven't suffered as much as I have. That's actually disrespectful to his teaching. If we think, in the Christian tradition, it's disrespectful to the suffering of Jesus on the cross to say, well, I've never experienced anything like the cross, so the cross has nothing to teach me. You know, no, I think Jesus would want to say, part of the reason I went through this was to show that I empathize with your suffering and that it doesn't need to be repeated anymore. So I don't know how it works, but I do have a sense from reading Viktor Frankl and many, many other people, from Jesus through the Buddha and through Rosa Parks, who a quote from who opens the book, which is a simple phrase I'd never heard attributed to her. I'd never heard anybody quote it, which is, knowing what needs to be done does away with fear. And I think that's similar. Like Viktor Frankl developed a deeper knowledge of what was really happening and what really mattered in the midst of this terrible set of circumstances. And Rosa Parks said, okay, I had a strategy. I wasn't on my own. I had these people around me who'd been planning this for a month. I wasn't just a tired old lady who sat down on a bus. I was actually part of a movement that had strategy and plans, and I knew what was needed to be done in that moment. And that enabled me to feel less visceral fear.
Yeah.
Knowing what needs to be done does away with, she says it does away with fear. I'm not sure I've experienced that in my life, but who am I to second guess Rosa Parks? She should have the last word, and I'm not going to say anything more unless you have something you really need me to say.
No, not at all. I do have one more question. Kevin says it's good to see us both on the same.
Yeah, screen. Good to hear from you, Kevin.
Amber, the last question I'm going to ask you is, how can we follow you? This has been so incredible.
Well, I'm pretty. I am trying to learn to love myself, but I'm pretty useless on Instagram, which is just about the only place you can follow me, at Gareth I. Higgins. And if anything I've said here is meaningful to you, please tell other folks about the book, How Not to Be Afraid. And you can go to hownottobeafraid.com. You can join the newsletter there, get a free chapter of the book.
Gareth also is the editor of The Porch magazine, which you can find online. A lot of stories, wonderful points like what we've been talking about today, friends. I started off saying that this book kind of picks up the pieces within me that are broken and puts them back together. And I experienced that in this conversation. So, Gareth, thank you.
And you're so welcome.
Go get the book, How Not to Be Afraid, 7 Ways to Live When Everything Seems Terrifying. Friends, we will come back together again next week at 3 o'clock Central, 1 o'clock Pacific, here at One Question with Pastor Adam. Until then, friends, God be with you.